content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Heart Letter as well. And first of all, I'm going to finish up the news briefs for the April 2023 Harvard Health Letter. A short article entitled, Can Varied Social Interactions Boost Well-Being? How many people have you interacted with today, and what kind of relationships do you have with them? A study led by our colleagues at Harvard Business School, published online October 2022 by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, suggests that the more diverse your portfolio of social interactions, the happier you'll be. Researchers evaluated the responses from four different surveys of 51,000 people around the world. Respondents reported their well-being or happiness and their previous day's social interactions, whether they interacted with strangers, acquaintances, friends, or family. Scientists found that the more diverse the relationships were, the happier respondents said they felt, over and above their total time spent interacting and the total number of interactions they had. In other words, beyond seeing your spouse or family every day, you may get additional happiness boost if you also see or chat with other people in your world, like coworkers, the checkout person at your grocery store, a neighbor, a dear friend, or a buddy you haven't talked to in a while. The study found only an association and doesn't prove conclusively that diverse social interactions improve well-being. But why not try it? The interactions might just make your day. The next short article in the Harvard Health Letter is entitled, Was It Something You Ate? Follow these steps when food makes you sick. Foodborne illness outbreaks occur frequently in the United States. Invisible microbes in food sicken an estimated 48 million people in our country every year, landing 128,000 in the hospital and killing about 3,000, according to the CDC. Culprits are usually viruses like the norovirus, bacteria like Salmonella, Clostridium perfringens, or Campylobacter, and parasites like Toxoplasma gondii, or toxins like those that can accumulate in shellfish. If you ingest them and get sick, you'll need to know how to respond. Sometimes food-related illness shows up within a few hours of eating contaminated food. But some bugs, like the norovirus and Escherichia coli, don't trigger symptoms for days. Either way, the signs are usually intense: nausea, vomiting, stomach cramps, or diarrhea, and possibly a low-grade fever. If you get dehydrated due to fluid loss from vomiting or diarrhea, you may feel lethargic, dizzy, or faint. Symptoms typically last for a couple of days. If they continue after a week, it may be less likely that food-related illness is making you sick. You should call your doctor to figure out what the problem is. If you suspect you have food-related illness, you'll need to rest as much as possible and avoid sugary drinks or alcohol, which can make symptoms worse. Stay away from others and try not to use the same bathroom so you don't spread any bugs you're carrying. And keep taking prescribed medications for chronic illnesses. You also need to stay hydrated. If it's hard to keep fluids down, take small sips. It's challenging, but it's important. Standing too suddenly when you're dehydrated can lead to fainting and injury. Severe dehydration can cause chemical imbalances and even lead to kidney failure, says Dr. Christopher Bao, an emergency medicine physician at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. If your symptoms don't include a high fever or bloody stool, Dr. Bao says, it's probably okay to take an antidiarrheal medication like loperamide, Imodium. If you can stand the symptoms, however, it may be wise to avoid medication and let your body expel the invaders. If you take the medication, there's a risk that it might improve the symptom, but prolong or worsen the illness, Dr. Bao says. Sometimes food-related illness requires a trip to the emergency room. The biggest warning sign are high fever and bloody stools. Dr. Bao says, you should also seek emergency care if you have severe dehydration or abdominal pain, if you're unable to keep medication down, or if you have a weakened immune system. This isn't the time to try to avoid care because you don't want to be a bother to anyone. Untreated bacterial food poisoning may progress into a life-threatening condition without antibiotics and intravenous fluids, Dr. Bao says. If you're caring for someone with a food-related illness, be on the alert for signs and symptoms that suggest the need for medical attention. Finally, from the Harvard Health Letter of April 2023. Here's an article entitled, Exercising with a Flare-Up of Knee Arthritis. Stay active by warming up, adjusting your exercise routine, and icing your knee after a workout. You might know it well by now. The painful bloom of swelling and stiffness is signals a flare-up of knee osteoarthritis. When it strikes and you muddle through the discomfort, you go easy on your knee and accept the idea that you'll have to brace for limited activities until the flare settles down. While that may be true for some activities like kneeling or squatting, it doesn't mean you have to stop exercising to protect your knee. Exercising is an important way to keep the joint flexible. You'll just have to go about exercising a little differently while your knee arthritis is acting up. For pointers, we turn to Christopher Morin, a physical therapist with Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Question, what are the risks of exercising when knee arthritis flares? The most significant risk is causing further irritation of the joint. Osteoarthritis is a long and slow degenerative process that happens when the cartilage or cushioning between the knee bones wears out. Activities that irritate the joint shouldn't worsen this degenerative change or cause structural damage, but they could cause greater discomfort and decreased function. You should try to reduce pressure and friction on your knee. Pressure would come from activities like running, tennis, basketball, or walking long distances. Friction would come from activities like deep knee bending or knee lunges that requires you to bend and hold the knee position for an extended period. Those activities can make your knee arthritis worse, and you'll want to avoid that so the joint can calm down. So what type of activities are safe when arthritis is bothering you? It depends on your symptoms, your severity, and your overall fitness. Sometimes simply decreasing the physical stress of an activity is all it takes. So maybe play pickleball instead of tennis, or take brisk walks rather than going for a run. But generally, we like to encourage activities that relieve pressure and friction on the knee, like riding a stationary bike, using an elliptical machine, practicing yoga, swimming, walking pain-free distances on flat terrain, or doing upper body strength training or core strengthening. Lower body strengthening can also be quite useful. Stronger leg muscles help relieve knee pain as they absorb some of the pressure you place on your knees. Stay away from exercises that might irritate the knee, though. A general rule of thumb is that exercising shouldn't increase your pain or swelling during or after the activity. Some people take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications like ibuprofen before an activity. Regular use of these medications is, however, associated with stomach ulcers, internal bleeding, and an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, or kidney failure. Instead, try warming up before the activity. It loosens the knee joint and the muscles that act on it. A heating pad or hot shower can be a good start. Spending 10 minutes on a stationary bike is great too. If your knee is still comfortable after the warm-up, you should be in good shape to work out. What should you do after the workout when your knee arthritis is flaring? Try icing your knee after a workout to decrease inflammation, but if you consistently find that you need to keep icing your knee in order to function the remainder of the day, consider either taking a bit of time off from exercising or toning down your routine. That could mean changing the type of exercise you do or reducing the amount of time you spend exercising. It may help to do a few 10-minute workouts rather than one 30- or 60-minute routine. Just remember, listen to your body. Let pain be your guide, but avoid long periods of inactivity. Stay as active as you can. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the issue of April 2023. And the first article is called Salt Shakedown: How and Why You Should Eat Less Sodium. This is, again, the Harvard Heart Letter of April 2023. Sodium, an essential component of salt, plays many vital roles in the body. This mineral helps to regulate blood volume, transmit nerve impulses, and contract muscle fibers. But we only need 500 milligrams of sodium a day to survive. The average American consumes 7 times that much. Health experts have been urging Americans to cut back on sodium for years. More than 2 decades ago, the landmark DASH, or Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension, sodium trial provided strong evidence that reducing sodium in the diet can lower blood pressure. Too much sodium can have other detrimental effects. Many studies reinforce the benefit of cutting back on salt, including a recent one that looked at cardiovascular biomarkers in stored blood samples from the original DASH trial. Researchers found that the diet progressively lowered biomarkers for heart injury and heart strain over the course of a 3-month study. Another study, which followed 177,000 people for 12 years, found that people who reported that they rarely or never added salt to their food had a lower risk of heart disease than those who usually salted their food. I definitely tell my patients with high blood pressure to pay attention to how much salt they eat, and I hand out copies of the DASH diet, says Dr. Catherine Sackmar, an internist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. The DASH diet emphasizes whole grains, fruits, vegetables, and low-fat dairy products, as well as fish, poultry, beans, nuts, and healthy oils. Following this diet will help you reach a daily sodium goal of less than 2,300 milligrams per day, which is the amount recommended by the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. 70% of the sodium in the average American diet comes from packaged, prepared, and restaurant foods. That's why checking food labels is an important first step for curbing your salt intake, says Dr. Sackmar, who makes a habit of checking labels herself. If I recommend a healthy lifestyle to my patients, I believe I should do them too, she says. Look at the Nutrition Facts panel for the sodium content, and make sure to check the serving size. Product package sizes have changed in recent years, which means the number of servings in a package may have changed as well. Many people don't realize that bread and related products like bagels, rolls, buns, pita bread, naan, and tortillas are often a major source of sodium in their diets, mainly because people eat these foods frequently. Processed meats like cold cuts, also known as deli meat or lunch meat, are also big contributors. My patients, many of whom are of Italian heritage, are surprised when I tell them a typical Italian sub sandwich often has more than 1,000 milligrams of sodium, says Dr. Sackmar. Even some uncooked meats and poultries have added salt. Salt or sodium appears in the ingredient list of many popular seasoning blends, and some also contain the flavor enhancer monosodium glutamate, or MSG, another sodium source. Look for salt-free herb and spice blends and seek out low-sodium or reduced-sodium versions of any condiments, sauces, or dressings you use frequently. Now we're going to continue with the Harvard Heart Letter. And the next article is called Ask the Doctor. And it features Dr. Christopher Cannon, who is the editor-in-chief. The question is, should I get a calcium score? Question. I'm wondering if I should get a test to check my calcium score. I'm 52 in good health. My LDL cholesterol is normal, but my father had a heart attack in his late 40s. And Dr. Cannon responds, the artery clogging plaque that builds up inside the heart's arteries contains cholesterol, inflammatory cells, scar tissue, and calcium. A coronary artery calcium scan, often called a calcium score, uses a special type of CT scan to look for that calcium, which is then quantified on a scale from 0 to over 1,000. A score of 0 means there is no calcified plaque. The higher the score, the more plaque is present. Finding from large studies link higher calcium scores to a higher risk of heart attack or stroke. While a calcium score can be informative, the scans don't make sense for everyone. Not all cholesterol plaques have become calcified in younger people, so the scans aren't usually recommended for people under 40. Anyone who already has known heart disease doesn't need a calcium scan. The results won't change a doctor's recommended treatment, which would very likely include a statin drug. But if you're at risk for heart disease but don't have any symptoms, knowing your calcium score can help you decide whether to start taking a statin. Statins can help lower your risk of heart disease even if your LDL cholesterol is in the normal range. Current guidelines suggest that people estimate their 10-year risk of cardiovascular disease with a calculator from the American College of Cardiology, available at www.health.harvard.edu/ASCVD. Statins are recommended for people with a score of 7.5% or higher, but the score doesn't capture other possible situations and may elevate your risk, including a family history of premature heart disease. Calcium scans are readily available, quick and painless. For the test, you just lie on your back. The scanner takes multiple pictures of your heart over the course of 5 minutes. It involves some radiation exposure, but not as much as a standard CT scan. The cost, which is usually about $100, is covered by insurance. But keep in mind, the test isn't mandatory. Another option is to skip the test and simply start taking a statin. But for someone like you who may have inherited a higher than normal heart disease risk, a calcium scan can give you a better sense of your risk and inform your doctor's advice. Now here's another article from the Harvard Heart Letter that's called Reaping the Rewards of Running. First of all, there's a short section called A Beginner's Guide to Running. And it says a run-walk program is an easy way to ease yourself into a running routine. After a five-minute walking warm-up, follow this schedule. Run for 1 to 2 minutes, then walk for 4 to 5 minutes until you have fully recovered, and do that 5 times. Try doing this routine every other day. Don't worry about speed. Run at a pace that feels right for you. Once this run-walk schedule feels comfortable, increase your running time to 3 or 4 minutes and walk for 2 to 3 minutes, or until you have recovered. When this becomes easy, run for 5 minutes and walk for a minute. Complete this pattern 5 times. Stick with a variation of this pattern, adjusting your running and walking time to fit your goals. Your goals might be consistency or pushing yourself to run longer and faster. About 50 million Americans say they participate in some form of running or jogging, which means it ranks among the most popular forms of exercise. But while running has many health benefits, it's a high-impact activity that carries a higher risk of injury. That's especially true for middle-aged and older people who have a higher baseline risk for heart disease than their younger counterparts, says Dr. Neil Lakdawala, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital, who will be running his 12th marathon this spring. There's a low frequency of adverse heart-related events in runners, and overall, the health benefits of running outweigh the risks. But people who have heart disease or risk factors for it, like high blood pressure and high cholesterol, and who are mostly sedentary, should check with their primary care doctor or cardiologist before embarking on a running regimen. You need to run consistently to reap the cardiovascular rewards, which include reduced blood pressure, lower cholesterol, improvements in sleep and mood, and weight loss. But injuries, which are fairly common in the casual and serious runner, can derail your motivation and progress. Overuse injuries include shin splints, plantar fasciitis, tendonitis, and stress fractures. For beginners, running too much too soon and too fast raise the risk of injury. Start slow and alternate walking and running. Also, be sure to do strength training. Muscle building exercises, especially those that strengthen all the different muscles in your legs and core, help protect against injuries by stabilizing and strengthening your bones and joints, which take a pounding when you run. Increase your mileage gradually. A common rule of thumb is not to increase your running distance more than 10% per week, although there isn't much evidence to support this advice. A slow, steady increase in mileage gives your body time to adapt. If any part of your feet, leg, or back starts hurting during or after a run, stop and rest for a few days. Physical therapists specialize in treating injuries that affect muscles, joints, or nerves. They can help you formulate a safe exercise plan, often featuring strength and dynamic stretching, based on your specific injury, and teach you how to perform the exercises correctly. If you run just 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week, you'll meet the recommended physical activity guidelines, which call for 75 minutes of vigorous intensity exercise weekly. But saving time isn't the main reason many runners love the sport, says Dr. Lakdawala. He enjoys the time spent outdoors and camaraderie with members of his running club. The improvement in his cholesterol profile has been an added bonus. Many runners also appreciate the challenge of participating in a race, whether it's a 5K or a much longer race. When I signed up to run the Boston Marathon, I had a time goal in mind, but whatever happens, the real joy for me is the journey in getting there, says Dr. Lakdawala. The next section we're going to read is called Gene Editing, a one-time fix for dangerously high cholesterol. And it has a short section that's called, How Does PCSK9 Affect Your Cholesterol Level? The PCSK9 protein acts like a tag that signals LDL receptors to be broken down in liver cells, which means there are fewer receptors to clear LDL from the bloodstream. As a result, LDL levels rise. High LDL accelerates the buildup of fatty plaque in the heart's arteries, raising heart attack risk. But therapies that either block or prevent the creation of PCSK9 have the opposite effect. More LDL receptors remain active in the liver to remove LDL. Blood levels of LDL plummet, lowering the risk of heart attack. And gene editing therapy disables a gene that regulates LDL cholesterol and is being tested in high-risk heart attack survivors. The article we're going to read is a look at the background and potential future of gene editing for heart disease. And we'll do that next time because we run out of time for today's episode. Like I said, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.